Now we come this evening to the second of these studies in the letter of Jude. I had forgotten just how rich a book Jude is. And I realize now all too late that it will take more than two studies to go into even a fraction of the truths in the book. What I really want to do tonight is to study the three warnings in verses 5 to 7, and the three kinds of evangelism in verses 22 and 23. And by way of introduction to those two sets of three, can we just have a look at another three sets of three, which you find in the letter. You remember that Jude is very fond of teaching in sets of three. There are little triads of truth all throughout the letter, and it's a characteristic of Jude's style. Now, you find one of these in the fourth verse. Admission has been secretly gained by some who long ago were designated for this condemnation, ungodly persons who pervert the grace of our God into licentiousness and deny our only despot, Lord and Master, Jesus Christ. And there's the first triad. First of all, they gain admission. Admission has been secretly gained. In other words, these are men who have wormed their way into the church by false profession. And secondly, they pervert the grace of our God into licentiousness. And they use grace as an excuse for immorality in much the same way in which James Hogg does in his book, The Confessions of a Justified Sinner. James Hogg claimed that since he is justified by faith and elect by God, this means he cannot be damned, and therefore he can live as he pleases. And so you get the story of his life, Hogg's life, in The Confessions of a Justified Sinner. And so these men here are like that. They pervert the grace of God into licentiousness. And thirdly, in verse 4, they deny the Master. It's the Greek word despotes, someone with absolute control. They deny their Master, the Lord Jesus Christ, the despot who bought them out of the slave market. And that's the first set of three. You find the second set of three in verse 8, if you care to look on to that. These men, in like manner, in their dreamings, they defile the flesh, which is a reference to open sensuality and sinful living. They defile the flesh. Secondly, in verse 8, they reject authority. They will not be ruled or governed by anyone other, of course, than themselves. You know that the word anarchy is the Greek word for no rule, anarchos, no rule. And anarchists reject the rule of law. But in fact, what they are rejecting is the rule of your law. They don't want to be ruled by you. They want to be the bosses. And that's what anarchy is about. And here they are in verse 8. These men, they reject authority. And the third of the triads in verse 8, they revile the glories, or they revile the glorious ones. And scholars are not certain what that refers to. It probably means that these men don't acknowledge the existence of the powers of evil. They don't acknowledge the spiritual world. They revile the glories. The third set of three is found in verse 11, where there is a reference, first of all, to the way of Cain, which was the way of lovelessness, because Cain's murdering his brother was the climax to a life of hate. Cain did not love his brother, and that was the characteristic of his way of life. They walk in the way of Cain. That is the mark of their lives. They are loveless people. And the second of the three is that they've abandoned themselves to the error of Balaam. And we know from the New Testament that Balaam taught Israel to sin. In other words, he taught religion without morals. Religion without morals. And that's something that really brings us up to the great controversies of the 1960s, when all the talk was about morals without religion. And the British rationalistic society, the rationalist press, and the humanist societies began stirring themselves. And there was a whole series of letters from Margaret Knight and Rex Knight and Margarita Lasky and Professor Ayers, the great atheists of our country, who claimed that you can have morals without religion. And you can have morals without religion. But this was countered by a series of letters from leading Christians who said that the tragedy of our country was not that you had morals without religion, but that you had religion without morals. And people were professing Christ and not living lives in accordance with their profession. And that is the error of Balaam, who taught Israel to sin. Woe to them, verse 11, for they walk in the way of Cain, lovelessness, and abandon themselves to the error of Balaam, religion without morals. And they perish in Korah's rebellion. And Korah, along with two men called Dathan and Abiram in Numbers chapter 16, were men who rose up in defiance against the leadership of Moses and Aaron. So once again, this is a reference to rebellion against authority. And if you take these three sets of three and analyze them, this is what you find: that four of them have to do with rebellion against lawful authority, and three of them have to do with immorality and a careless lifestyle, and one of them has to do with lovelessness. And it's the testimony of Scripture, as well as the evidence of history, that these three always go together in the life of man. Lawless rebellion against proper rule and proper government is linked with immorality and careless living, and that in turn is linked with lovelessness. Take these four: denying the master, rejecting authority, reviling the glories, and rebelling like Korah. Four instances of rebelling against authority. And link them with this three: perverting grace into licentiousness, defiling the flesh, and the error of Balaam, religion without morals. The first four are linked with the second three, and the second three is linked with the last one, which is the way of Cain, which is lovelessness. And in quite practical terms, what Jude is saying here is this, that when a generation rejects all forms of authority, whether it's the authority of the police, such as you see in the riots at Wapping over the weekend, or authority inside the church, or the authority of God, or the authority of the teacher in the classroom, or the authority of parents at home, all of them ordained by God. When a generation rejects that, sooner or later, there will be immorality and a casual lifestyle. And sooner or later, that will emerge as lovelessness. My Christian friend, where do you think the heartlessness and the cruelties and the lovelessness of today's society come from? Where do you think the child abuse comes from? Where do you think the abuse of old people in the streets comes from? They come from rejection of God-appointed authority. And that's the message of these three sets of three. And this is the background to three warnings and three invitations to evangelism. And I want to think of these just now. First of all, the three warnings, and they're found in verses 5 to 7. In verse 5, you get the instance of Israel redeemed from Egypt, but dying in the wilderness. In verse 6, you get the instance of the holy angels who rebelled against the throne of God in the prehistoric rebellion in heaven. And in verse 7, you get the judgment of God on the cities of the plain, Sodom and Gomorrah. And these three illustrations of judgment are interesting because they're all held together by two things that they have in common. The first is this: they all have to do with something that is unnatural. It was not natural for Israel to rebel against God. It was very perverted of her to rebel against God. You see, God had loved her and chosen her and performed miracles in Egypt for her and beaten the wizards of Pharaoh for her. God had raised up Moses for her. God had killed every firstborn creature for her. And the Passover lamb, with its blood of redemption, had been slain for her. And God had brought her through the Red Sea and constituted her a nation. All of that. And yet Israel lamented and gurned and complained and found fault. She blamed Moses, she blamed Aaron, she blamed God. So that her history for 40 years was a history of gurning. Read it in the book of Numbers. Now you see, it wasn't natural for Israel to do that. Just as it's not natural for a child to turn against loving parents who have cherished him and cared for him. It's perverse of a child to turn against parents who love him. It's sinful. It's wicked. It's heartless. It's a twisted thing to do. It's against nature. And in the same way in verse 6, it was unnatural for the angels to leave their first princehood. That's how Wycliffe translates the word position here in verse 6. The angels that did not keep their own position, their princehood, their holy estate. And it was unnatural for them to do it in two ways. In the first place, they had no need to rebel against God. Why on earth rebel against God? They had been created for God's pleasure and God's possession. They had everything they needed in glory. And yet along came this upstart, Lucifer. He whispered magic in their ears and thoughts of having a tilt against the throne. And that was that. And the book of Revelation tells us that when the dragon was thrown out of heaven, he dragged with him a third part of the stars of heaven. A third of the angels fell away with Satan. But it wasn't natural. They had everything they needed. And in the second place, it was unnatural for the angels, these fallen angels, to consort with the daughters of men, because many Christian scholars interpret Genesis chapter 6 in that light, that somehow the fallen wicked angels, when they came down, they lusted after the daughters of men, Genesis chapter 6. And there were unholy liaisons, and the unnatural progeny of those godless unions were the giants that walked the earth in those days. That's what Genesis says. There were giants in the earth in those days, monsters, freaks. And that's why we read that when God looked down on that age and saw the wickedness, the whole earth was filled with violence, he was sick at heart and sorry that he had made men. It was unnatural for the angels to behave like this. And thirdly, in verse 7, it was unnatural for the men of Sodom to live as they lived. We read in the book of Genesis that when the handsome men came to Sodom to save Lot and his wife, and these handsome men were angels, as they often are in the Old Testament. You don't get many angels in the Old Testament with wings floating about, like the angels on Christmas cards. Angels in the Old Testament are good-looking men. And when they came to the city and stayed with Lot, the men of the city besieged the house, a mob shouting, "Bring out these men that we may know them." Meaning know them sexually. Can you imagine what life was like in a city like that? Talk about AIDS! Wasn't natural to behave like this. And the third thing that ties these three warnings together is this, that in these three illustrations, actions determine destinies. And it's interesting to consider that they probably had not started off as they ended. You know that people rarely start off as they end. The Israelites in Egypt, they started off longing for freedom. They were glad to get out. They ended as rebels. The angels in heaven, they started off next to the throne. They were part of the armies of God. And they finish as demons. And the men of Sodom, the women of Sodom, were probably ordinary men and women in early days. But they finished as infamous examples of unnatural lust. You see, our actions breed our destinies. Do you know C.S. Lewis's book, Transposition and Other Addresses? It contains a great sermon he once preached in Oxford called The Weight of Glory. And he speaks about the seriousness of our actions. He says, "It is a serious thing to live in a society of potential gods and goddesses, and to remember that the dullest and most uninteresting person you talk to may one day be a creature which, if you saw it now, you would be strongly tempted to worship, or else a horror and a corruption such as you now meet at all, only in a nightmare. And all day long, we are in some degree helping each other to one or other of these destinations. There are no ordinary people. You have never talked to a mere mortal. Nations, cultures, arts, civilizations, these are mortal. But it is with immortals that we joke, work with, marry, snub, and exploit. Immortal horrors or everlasting splendors." The old preacher put it like this: "Sow a thought, reap an act. Sow an act, reap a habit. Sow a habit, reap a character. Sow a character, reap a destiny." Because thoughts have an uncanny way of becoming acts, which become habits, which become characters, which become destinies. And every day, and every moment, and every hour, and every second, right now, we are manufacturing our destinies. Like the Israelites, like the angels in heaven, like the men of Sodom, actions determine destinies. And it's in the light of those three warnings that at the end of this letter, Jude invites us to engage in three kinds of evangelism. And in closing, I want you to look at this in verses 22 and 23. In verse 22, the first kind is persuasion evangelism. Convince some who doubt. There are many good people who can be brought to Christ, you know, like that. Good folk who are just filled with doubts, not so much about God's existence as about God's love and God's kindness and God's willingness to accept them. I've been reading a lovely story in the December issue of The Life, the Banner of Truth magazine. It's written by a man called Walla, who claims to be a Dutch pastor, but of course that's not his name. And the story is about a Dutch businessman called Carmon, and that's not his name either, of course, but there is such a man. And Carmon was a strange recluse of a man, a grey, white-faced man, who came to church but never came to communion because he kept telling the elders he was totally unworthy to come to the Lord's Supper. And he lived in a huge mansion, and in just one or two rooms of this mansion, because the mansion had been his home in earlier days when he was a very prosperous businessman. But during the war, the military had taken over the house, and he was living in a small flat along with an aged housekeeper. And it was Christmas Eve, and the time had come for him to die because he'd been very ill. And the housekeeper phoned the pastor, and the pastor came out near midnight on Christmas Eve and went to the dying man's room. And he sent out the nurse and the housekeeper and invited the pastor to come near. He said, "I want to tell you my story before I die." And apparently he had been a very wild man in his younger days as a student, and lived a profligate life and denied the gospel and denied God. And then he met this lovely girl called Marike, and she fell in love with him, and he fell in love with her, and they married, and she brought him back to God and to Christ. And then Marike died, and he was left alone, and he lapsed into becoming a bitter man, a bitter, twisted man, filled with aggression and resentment against God. And Marike had presented him with her daughter, and he says, "Our child was dear and happy, always happy, and it was just that which I could endure no longer. And one day I struck her because she laughed. I struck her with the back of my hand, flush in her face, and I was wearing a ring with a diamond in it, and her cheek bled. I saw that, but I did not take her in my arms, and I did not kiss her, and I did not say I was sorry. I simply walked away. She developed blood poisoning and was dead after 2 days. No one ever suspected it, and you are the first one I have told. And I stood at her bedside And she smiled at me once more. Marieke. Marieke. Carmen, said the pastor, surely you have prayed to God for forgiveness. But there was no answer. Marieke, Marieke, was the girl's name. Surely you know there's grace from God. Even the murderer with Jesus on the cross received forgiveness. But he fixed his eye on me. Yes, he murmured, murderer, that's the right word. But did the murderer of Golgotha murder his own child, a dear, innocent child? An innocent child? The murderer was saved. But not Herod, who killed the children at Bethlehem. I don't dare to meet my wife and child up there. And so all through the night of Christmas Eve, the pastor urged Christ on this man. I spoke of a love of God which is so great that it made a light to rise in Christ, which drives away all shadows of guilt and remorse. Yes, which drives away even the shadows which doubt the reality of his endless mercy. Persuasion, evangelism, convince some who doubt. What else could I say to the man? To him who lies broken on the battlefield, burning with thirst, one gives a sip of pure water and nothing more. And I prayed with him. When I had finished, he looked up at me, and it was as if an angel had touched his eyes and cleansed them of all anxiety and all fear. The curtains! He whispered, the curtains! The man lived in darkness, you see, with curtains drawn. I pushed them aside. Morning light stood before the windows. Carmen looked at the dawn, drank of the rising sun, came to Christ, and went home to God on Christmas Eve. Persuasion. Evangelism. The second kind of evangelism is found at the start of verse 23, and it's rescue evangelism. Save some by snatching them out of the fire. And the some here are men and women who are ripe for hell, and ripe for ruin. A few months ago, I was dealing with the case of a man who was a decided and a very sick alcoholic. He was dying of dreadful cirrhosis of the liver, and his brain tissues had been so ruined by excessive drinking that now he was having fits and spasms in public, on buses and railway platforms, as some advanced alcoholics sometimes do. He'd got through two marriages, two divorces. He had wrecked the lives of two women, and he was now involved with a third woman. He'd gone through endless jobs. He'd no friends. He had become, as many alcoholics become, manipulative. He used people. He had become sycophantic. Anywhere for a bed, anywhere for a drink, anywhere for a soft touch, for cash. He'd gone through countless clinics, doctors, cures, consultants. And his only hope now was that he had a few Christian acquaintances who were still praying for him. But if the man comes to Christ and he has been at the doors of death several times, he will be a trophy of rescue evangelism. Rescued from the fires of hell. Verse 23, save some by snatching them out of the fire. And the third kind of evangelism in the second half of verse 23 is compassion evangelism. And on some have mercy with fear, hating even the garment spotted by the flesh. Mr. Anderton's a very brave Christian man, taking his stand in public against godlessness and immorality. And all he says is true. And anyone with any sense knows that what the man is saying is true. I listened to the Jimmy Young show on Friday morning. I don't normally listen to the Jimmy Young show, but there was some rather strange music on Radio 3, music from Thailand, I think. So I switched over, and there was this leftish MP disagreeing with the chief constable, saying he was talking a lot of nonsense about immorality. And Jimmy Young pointed out to him, he said, didn't you know that 90% of the phone calls that have come in are in support of the chief constable and his views? And then another man phoned in, and he said, I'm having this liaison with a married woman who has discovered that her husband is part of the gay community. And so we're all exposed to AIDS. And I can't see that we're doing anything wrong. I tell you, it shows how deeply entrenched the ranks of godlessness are in our country. My friend, we have a long, long way to go. But how would you approach an AIDS victim if he was looking for Christ? The imagery in this verse here is from the world of leprosy. On some have mercy with fear, hating even the garment spotted by the flesh. If you read the rules governing leprosy in the Old Testament, apparently the Jews believed that even the walls of a house could be contaminated. And even clothes could be contaminated. And so what is needed is compassion evangelism. And if you're going to engage in any of these kinds of evangelism, whether the evangelism of persuasion, or the evangelism of rescue, or the evangelism of compassion, there's certainly one thing you will need, and that's a God who can keep you. And that's what the grand doxology at the end of Jude says. Listen to these words. Read them with me. Now to him who is able to keep you from falling. And you'll need that kind of a God if you're going to be an evangelist. A God who can keep you from falling. And not only so, says Jude, he is able to present you without blemish before the presence of his glory with rejoicing. Present you without blemish. And the Greek word present there means to exhibit or to show off or to set forth. And a very good example of presenting would be the example of a diamond cutter starting with an ugly lump of stone and chiseling it, shaping it, cutting it, putting on the facets, polishing, and then presenting it to the public. And according to the New Testament, that is what God is going to do with you. In Ephesians 5, Paul says, Christ loved the church that he might present the church to himself in splendor, without wrinkle and without spot and without any such thing. Christ loved the church that he might present it to himself. An exhibition piece, a showpiece. And Paul uses the same word in Colossians chapter 1 and verse 22. Do you know this great verse? He says, you who once were estranged, hostile in mind, doing evil deeds, you he has now reconciled in order to present you blameless and irreproachable. You see, it's the same idea that upstairs we're going to be cleaned up and perfect and flawless so that the saints of God in the world to come are going to be God's showpieces and God's exhibition pieces. And according to Ephesians, one day God is going to say to all the angels, and the angels are going to be looking on in wonder because the angels have never known anything like this. God will say, well, look what I did with this one. Do you remember that awful man? Do you remember what he used to be like? Do you remember his temper and his moods? Well, that's how he started off. And look at him now. Do you remember that frightful woman? Look at her now. You see, God is not only able to keep you from falling, he's able to present you without blemish before the presence of his glory with rejoicing. And friend, if you're going to become an evangelist, whether a persuasion evangelist or a rescue evangelist or a compassion evangelist, And it's high time that some of you became evangelists. Then, that's the kind of God you're going to need. Amen. May the Lord add a blessing to the preaching of His word, to His name be honor and praise.